If you waken that beast, it will destroy us all.
You can listen to this naysayer, but I promise you this. If we succeed, all will share in the wealth of the mountain. You will have enough gold to rebuild Escaroth 10 times over!
All of you! Listen to me! You must listen! Have you forgotten what happened to Dale? Have you forgotten those who died in the firestorm? And for what purpose? The blind ambition of a mountain king. So riven by greed, he could not see beyond his own desire!
You have no right. No right to enter that mountain.
I have the only right.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me today are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And Dave Trumbore.
I am Death.
Yes, also an associate editor. Today we will be talking about The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. I don't know how to pronounce it correctly.
Smaug.
No one gives a shit. He's a fictional fucking character. I'll pronounce his name however I fucking want. So we have a few topics to touch on. First off, just general thoughts about the film, but specifically wanted to talk about its box office. This weekend, it performed well in terms of what one would expect from a blockbuster, but slightly underperformed, especially in comparison to An Unexpected Journey. It wasn't a drastic drop-off, but it did say something about Unexpected Journey possibly turning some people off, and perhaps general fatigue or disinterest for what is the last big blockbuster of the year. Sorry, 47 Ronin, no one gives a shit. Unless I'm wrong, unless there's a huge 47 Ronin contingent that I don't know about. It's expensive, but Hobbit, there was some drop-off, and then the VFX are problematic in their own way, and they sort of signal something, what I believe is telling about Peter Jackson's career trajectory and where he might be headed. But I've already posted my review, so I want to hand it over to you guys, what your thoughts were in general on the film.
Go ahead, Adam.
I know everyone is saying it's like a huge step up, but for me, I thought it was fine. I thought it was better than the first movie, but not significantly. The bloat is still just... it just bogs it down. There's so many weird sidetracks. It's like, for anyone who was really upset that Tom Bombadil wasn't in The Lord of the Rings, I feel like this is the trilogy for them. But when you go to Bjorn's house for 10 minutes and it does nothing. Like, it serves no purpose. And, you know, they're fighting spiders and... all of that would be okay to me if there were interesting characters, but I don't feel like there's enough character focus. I felt like it was strange that Bilbo was kind of barely in this one. He wasn't really the focus until the last portion of the film. I did like Evangeline Lilly's Tauriel. I liked her. I thought Legolas was fine. Just kind of unnecessary to bring him back. He didn't really serve any purpose. But for me, I don't know. I guess I just have to come to terms with the fact that this trilogy isn't gonna be for me. And the Lord of the Rings are some of my favorite movies of all time, but these two movies just do not do it for me. I just felt like there's just so much bloat and so much extra and so much added on. And I know that sounds like a talking point, but I was defending the decision to turn The Hobbit into a trilogy. I was like, no, there's got to be like worthwhile story. It's got to be fine. But you know, I'm seeing with these two movies that it's just not. And so I liked the design of Smaug, the dragon. It wasn't an entirely like not worthwhile experience watching it, but it kind of felt like it was just okay. But it's not one I'm eager to revisit soon.
Okay, and Dave?
Yeah, for me, I enjoyed the first one. I thought it was a lot of fun. It does have problems with being a little bloated. The whole thing probably could have just been two movies of this length and get through the entire thing and be done with it. That's obviously not what they really wanted to do. I think even Jackson said that there's a really fun action sequence in this one that's a barrel sequence. I don't want to talk about it too much right now, but I think that Jackson actually said that would have been the middle point if he did everything in two movies. So the midpoint of the second movie would have been pretty much the end of the first movie had he done it in two installments. So that just goes to show how much kind of extra stuff they've added in. That being said, I think they did a better job of filling in the time that they decided to add on this one than they did the first one. The first one was a lot of traveling scenes and establishing shots of just like, look how beautiful this land is, which is great, but when you see it for the 50th time in the same movie, it feels like filler, which is what it is. This one, at least, they moved to different scenes, and I thought each of the different settings that they had a really kind of unique look to them. The design was really nice. The character of the settings was actually more well established than the character of the characters themselves, which I found kind of interesting. Now, it is tough when you've got, you know, a dozen different protagonists to try to, you know, make them unique, make them stand out in a way. And they did it with little character things. Like, I don't know what the names of the guys are, but the one with the horn, the old guy that has, like, the ear horn, you know, they don't really call him by name, but they just show him he shows up every once in a while. So it's kind of like a running gag for stuff like that. They tried doing things between Tauriel and, I think, Feely was the
Killy.
Dwarf.
It's Killy.
It was Killy. Okay. So they tried doing some things to sort of make the guys stand out a little bit. But again, to Adam's point, this was really Thorin's movie, so Richard Armitage's movie. And I think they did pretty well with sort of broadening his character out a little bit. Not as well as they could have. That's the disappointing thing, is that they have such rich backstory to draw from on all these different characters. And unfortunately, it kind of takes a backseat to making a pretty picture and making a crazy action sequence rather than actually establishing character. So that hasn't changed. But overall, I really did enjoy this film. And originally when I saw the first one, I thought it was obviously okay to judge them on the individual film's merits, but I think it's going to be better as a trilogy. Now, it's not to say it's going to be as dark or as cinematic or as worthy of awards talk as the Lord of the Rings trilogy was, but I think it's just like a fun, light trilogy introducing Lord of the Rings. I think it's going to be okay.
See, my feeling regarding the bloat is that with Unexpected Journey, it feels like it's going in circles, and it's going places that I don't particularly care about. Like, yeah, the Bjarn stuff is kind of pointless, but at the same time, to me, what Desolation of Smaug really does is it helps expand Middle-earth in a way that I think is one of the benefits that these prequels can have. Because really, I never really was like, yeah, let's do The Hobbit, which is fine. I just feel like, if you're going to do The Hobbit, well, guess what? Now you can go more places. And I liked Lake Town, and I liked going inside Erebor. Right. So I felt.
Did we really need to learn like the political machinations going on at Lake Town? Like, it just felt like there was no propulsion to the story. It didn't feel like it was moving.
I don't really think they got bogged down in that as much as I think it was just simple setup so that they could, and I won't spoil it, that something needs to happen later in the film that those machinations have to exist in order for one character to be in a certain place.
My point to judging this as an entire trilogy is, like, again, it's not good for the individual film, but when, you know, there's more things that are going to happen, obviously, in the third film. So some of that feels like set up for things that are maybe going to happen later. But yeah, it does kind of feel like, here's the thing, okay, now let's just move on to the next one. It never feels fully realized or complete. Everything feels like, even the end of the movie feels like...
It's the only one with a straight-up cliffhanger.
Just
the
like
only one. Everyone,
like,
all the other films are like, and here is a journey. We're going to keep walking forward.
Yeah. There's no ending to this movie.
It's just a 9-hour movie.
That's the thing.
Haven't seen the end yet. Yeah.
And for those who don't know, this film was unexpected. That originally it was just supposed to be Unexpected Journey and There and Back Again. And right. Peter Jackson's like, we have enough footage. We need a little more footage to make a third film. We have too much footage to cut away.
Actually, no.
Really? Because what it was... No, because what it... I mean, maybe they changed it, but I remember...
I know what's new in Smaug, and the entire spider sequence is new, and then basically the last...
Wait, the spider... Okay, well, that's odd that the spider sequence is new, because that's in the book.
That's in the book, yeah.
And then the... basically, the action sequence at the end of the movie is completely new. So basically...
That I could believe.
They had
that I believe,
basically, but they had a way of like doing this story and like teasing it out so that it had, you know, forward movement, and we didn't feel like we were going in circles. And then he was like, "Well, we got to expand it to three. Let's just add more action sequences," which doesn't feel like.
Honestly, though, I think that action scene at the end really works well, because I think it establishes A, it does a good job of expanding Erebor as its own place, and B, it really speaks to the dwarves' talents. It makes them feel like more of a cohesive group, which is, I think, the best way to interpret them. Because as far as individuals go,
yeah.
I think that ship has sailed. I know who Balin is, and I know who... Now I kind of know who Keely is, and I know who Thorin is. And Adam, just briefly to your point about it doesn't really feel like Bilbo's film anymore, I don't really... That doesn't really bother me, just like Lord of the Rings isn't really Frodo's film. I mean, it's just... It expands to a lot of people.
But the movie's called The Hobbit.
Yeah, I don't care. It could be called The Prequels. Like, it doesn't matter. To me, like, a title is irrelevant simply because... You know, someone in this film says The Desolation of Smaug. Like, it doesn't, because Smaug is in the film. Like, it's just one of those things where a title is secondary to the plot.
Well,
and
point,
I don't
too,
care if it's,
Lord
if it's,
Rings.
I think if it's more serviceable. Yeah, that's the thing. If it's The Lord of the Rings, it's like, well, then why isn't all the films about Sauron?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the thing. That doesn't really bother me.
Well, I didn't mind focusing on Thorin more, but I just felt like... I don't have a connection to any of these characters like I did with The Lord of the Rings, and I felt like this film was a chance for me to like kind of draw that connection. Even mm-hmm. with Bilbo, I didn't have a huge connection with him in the first film, because he just, you know, he spent 45 minutes in his head debating over whether to go on this journey or not, which doesn't really tell me much about him. So in this movie, I still don't feel like I can relate to Bilbo or have like a connection to his character that I'm like really, really rooting for.
I think
though I do enjoy like watching, like I enjoyed his interaction with Smaug at the end of the film.
See, that
but
didn't
just,
really...
I feel like this is the characters in this movie just don't connect. And you can say that, you know, we're waiting for a trilogy to fill out, but that was the same with Lord of the Rings. Like the first two movies still introduced things that were going to come back later, but they still felt worthwhile.
Right, and Dave said that, like, you know, it's not good that these movies can't stand on their own, like the Lord
yeah.
of the Rings films. But again, we might get a payoff, which would make this a cohesive trilogy. But I agree, as individual films, I do like Desolation of Smaug more, but all of these films, it's not like, even Desolation of Smaug, which I liked much more than Unexpected Journey, it's not like, man, I got to see that again. It's not like Lord of the Rings, where I saw them more than once in the theater
yeah.
and was happy to do so. And then happier to not only buy the film, but then buy the extended edition. Because
right.
I already feel like these are extended editions.
Yeah,
yeah.
If there's an extended edition out there, I almost don't want to watch it.
I mean, there is. There's one of The Hobbit. There's an extended edition. Not The Hobbit, but Unexpected Journey. And I'm sure all three of them will get it. And I'm just not sure why. And although in this one it was pretty fun, I did enjoy the moment where... in Unexpected Journey, I feel one of the most bloated parts is Radagast. And
yeah.
I like that in Desolation of Smaug, Gandalf is basically like, no, 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 it's okay, don't come back.
Like, I got it. Don't come back.
He's like, I got this, Radagast. Don't.
Which again, to that point, like, why even include Radagast in the first place? Again, maybe he'll come back in the third movie.
I'm thinking it's for a third
purpose.
Yeah. A third part,
but,
yeah.
And I did like
everything is literally left hanging. Like,
yeah.
Some things are quite literally left hanging. Other things are just cliffhangers. Like the entire thing is
yeah.
just cliffhanger.
And I really like what they're doing with the necromancer. Not to spoil that
yeah,
either.
The best stuff is with Gandalf.
Yeah, that's
but you only see like a tenth of the time. Really, it feels
yeah.
like anyway. I don't think.
I mean, it's a subplot, and also where that subplot is spinning out, the way that subplot is trying to connect to the other plots with Azog and now his little buddy and like those boring characters that are just like, ah, we need, you know, what it would be like, you know how in the Fellowship of the Ring, how there's sort of the main Uruk Hai guy, he's the guy
mm-hmm.
whose head gets cut off. It'd be if like he kept coming back instead of just chopping off his head and going
and
on with
him,
your day.
They gave him real dialogue to further the story.
Yeah,
because
okay.
we need to know what his
we need to know that he's like
and his motivation.
Grr, I hate Thorin. Grr, like that's him. That's him, and I hate the world of men. Ah. Orcs aren't particularly interesting characters. They're cannon fodder. That's really what an orc is.
The problem is they were the bad guys were kind of interesting in the Lord of the Rings one, A, because we didn't see them a lot, B, because their look or whatever one or two lines they had were established, it established their character fairly quickly. Like the general kind of goblin, whatever he is, that leads the hordes. I can't remember which movie it is because I've seen them all together so much. But the guy that, like, you know, they're launching stuff from.
I know what you're saying. They're launching stuff towards Gondor. He's the one with sort of like the weird, like, puffy face, and he's I know who you're talking about.
Let's call him Puffy Face.
Puffy Face.
The orc. Yeah, but basically, like, within 30 seconds, you've established a character that people are going to like and remember, and not need to know anything else about. Whereas in this case, we have a couple characters that they look kind of cool, I guess.
Not really.
Yeah.
I don't think they do. I think, and part of that is you know, maybe we use this as a seg. Is the needless CGI of them. I don't understand why Azog. I didn't understand the first one and the second. Why is he completely digital? That is not Gollum.
Because Jackson can.
Because
I'm impressed
he
by
can.
The tech of it, but I don't think
I'm not impressed by the tech of it. I think he looks I think it's...
Some of it is, and some of it is not impressive. And I think the ones that are kind of suspect are the ones that they had to go back and kind of like redo or do last second, because you can look at some of them just like, holy shit, this is not finished whatsoever. Now, maybe it's a difference in high frame rate versus regular. What did you guys see it in? What formats?
I saw it in regular 3D, thank goodness.
Okay. Yeah, regular 3D. They're not screening
2D,
it in HFR for press.
Interesting. We haven't heard anything about that this year, really.
Jackson didn't want him to, because he blames the negative reviews on the first one of the, like, HFR. He said people were just, they were reviewing the tech and the movie, and then they got angry with the tech, so they didn't like the movie. So I just wanted to be all about the movie this time.
I mean, to be fair, the tech made it much harder to get into the film. However, I stick by my original grade of the film itself. I rewatched the film on HBO Go. You know, so it's just the film on its own. I still have the same problems with it. So the HFR definitely made it a slog, and I'm so happy I didn't have to watch it that way again. It's sort of like an admission that, like, yeah, this didn't work.
Some of these action scenes, that like it looked like they were set up for HFR, because as I was watching them, I was just like, what the hell is going on right now? Like,
I was getting a headache.
Who
it was
the
so
what.
Dizzying. Yeah.
And I think it's set up for HFR so you can actually see, you know, what crazy thing Legolas is doing this time. So, I don't know. That's
he can move at even higher speeds.
Yeah.
Legolas
with his
little
high frame rate.
With his little combo meter of orc kills during the barrel scene. Oh, that's just... It felt so... At times, you could just see them peeking out. It's like, oh, how do we top what he did in the other movies?
That kind of bothered me, though, too. If anything, he should be having less crazy kills.
Exactly. He should be less
Lord of the Rings. Because now they're going to be real shitty and lame when kids watch this. And then they go see Lord of the Rings, and they're like, oh, all right, what happened to him?
He's gonna go back and redo the effects George Lucas style.
Oh, God. He's going to kill more orcs.
He's the new George Lucas. Like, this is the prequel trilogy that's not as
well,
good.
Maybe... I wouldn't go that far. I think there's more passion there, and I also don't think... I think also it's a little...
I was half kidding,
yeah. Also, I think Jackson is more has more of being a human being than... Lucas is kind of a cold technician, where I do think Peter Jackson is honestly trying to get some human emotion out of there. It's just his obsession with tech is starting to get in the way.
Yeah, and that was more to my point of it's just like CG everything.
Right.
And I was talking to guys offline about this. Last year when the first film came out, I got to see a presentation by Joe Letteri, who's, I don't know if he's the head of Weta, but he's basically like the head of their VFX department. And I mean, it was a crazy presentation to see in person, because just like the amount of work that goes into it, what it amounts to in simple terms is they filmed the movie once practically, and then it's almost like they completely reshoot it again just within a computer's landscape. So it's almost like they filmed the entire thing first, and then they use that practical stuff on film as a template for replacing everything from every blade of grass to every hair on your head digitally with CGI. So it's completely insane. In my mind, that's completely insane. But that's what they want to do, and that's why you have things like the Goblin Cave, the Goblin City in the first one, that's like completely CG.
Yeah, that's an animated movie.
It's an animated movie. Or you have the sequence at the end of this one that's within Erebor. Like, I don't know how much of that. I'd have to see the presentation again on this movie, which I'm sure will be on the Blu-ray, to show what they shot and what was filled in digitally. Because it's that just blows my mind. I mean, like, on a tech level, it's amazing. But at the same time, like, do we have to do that, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite as seamless. Like, I mean, in Fellowship of the Ring, they're definitely, I mean, the mines of Moria are clearly all CG, but it feels like a place. And also, they're clearly using some, there are some practical sets woven in there. Like when they're in Balin's tomb, that's clearly a set.
Yeah, it's a set.
Whereas, I don't know if they're in anything in Erebor as actually there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's kind of, now that I'm thinking back on it, it reminds me of Nick Arcade. Where you're running around trying to do things and it's a blue screen.
Avoid the dragon.
Avoid the dragon on Nick Arcade. Yeah, it's pretty much the thing. It's like,
at
I mean,
the same
and
time,
you go.
Like, I was yelling at my TV screen when I was watching those idiot kids not able to touch the power up.
Yeah.
I'm kind of still yelling at the screen now, so nothing has changed there.
Crawl that way, you asshole. Yeah, exactly.
Well, what's so interesting about the. And, like what Dave said is that they paint over everything. There's a on Badass Digest has an image of the actor who's playing the orc who's God, I don't remember these guys' names.
It doesn't matter. Scary
Azog's,
orc.
Azog's brother in the movie is CG created, but that was an actor in this really badass, like really kind of scary makeup, kind of like the Uruk-hai from Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And he filmed his entire role that way, and they can just. Like, to me, it's amazing that they can just decide, you know, nope, that's not working, we're going to paint over him, which signals to me that probably Azog, there was someone in practical makeup that way, because why would they hire someone on as his brother in the second movie and not make him CG as well? But just that an actor can be there performing an entire scene and, like,
And this is,
movie.
Like, he's in the this is not motion capture, just to make this clear.
Oh, no, he's in full makeup. It's exactly like the Uruk-hai in that you would remember. Like, the one who gets his head chopped off. He's kind of like that. But he's got, like, metal, like, sticking out of his head, and it's really scary. I wonder if
now
Jackson's just like, oh, that's too scary.
No, just picture the actor who went through this entire, like, series of movies. God knows how many hours of makeup and costume every day. And then they're like, yeah, we're just going to do
actually, I believe it's the same actor who played the Winklevoss twin in Social Network who's not Armie Hammer. It wasn't Josh Pence, because that should be his thing now.
That would be sad.
They wore much less armor in Social Network, from
they
what
did.
I remember. So.
Yeah, so I agree. It's kind of baffling. It feels also like a huge waste of money. Just like, why? Why would you do... And people, I don't know how much that film cost. And it's weird because it seems like a thing now, or maybe just... I'm thinking to X-Men Days of Future Past, and they're like, this is the second most expensive movie Fox has ever made. And I don't really care about that because that's not my money. It's not like, I'm not a Fox shareholder. I don't give a shit. But it's like, why not report on this cost? Because this has to be crazy expensive. I don't care. Unless, like, just New Zealand is like, we'll pay for the whole thing. Have it on us.
Jackson owns, like, a third of New Zealand.
He does. That's true. And
sure
he employs half of it, so.
Yeah, and I think the reason that Days of Future Past is so expensive is because of that cast. I mean, you got to pay to get all those
two casts, yeah.
That is true, even though I don't think one of them will be in the film very much.
Oh, I'm sure a lot of them will be in the film very much.
You think that both casts are in it a lot? Because I think...
No, I'm sure a lot of them won't be in the film.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, there's only going to be half.
I think it's really going to be X-Men Days of X-Men First Class plus
Wolverine.
That's the game.
Seems like it, yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I am okay with that.
Sure.
But swinging back to Desolation of Smog, there's a VFX problem, and I think that kind of stems from... Jackson, people not telling him no. It's a power thing. It's just that kind of guy from the Lord who made the Lord of the Rings, the guy who kind of looked like a hobbit. That guy is gone now because he is hugely successful. And
well, go ahead.
I'm not saying, and let me put it this, and I just want to make it very clear. I don't think like Jackson's become a bad person or anything. I just think as an artist, as someone who's like, I can do this now and I can do that now, like someone who has creative instincts are now unencumbered, and that becomes problematic because they're not all gems.
Yeah, and see, that's the problem, is the unencumbrance there, because it does, we've been ragging on it for a while, but there are certain things in this movie that you can't do practically, or it'd be like a Rube Goldberg machine. You'd have to do it like a billion times to get one take that everything works right. Again, I'm talking about a barrel sequence, which I thought was a hell of a lot of fun from beginning to end.
I agree. It's fun.
Some of it was unnecessary, but from beginning to end, it was a hell of a lot of fun. It's the most fun I think I've had in a sequence in a movie theater in some time. You can't do that practically. There are certain things that they did in that sequence that just like blew your mind, but there's no way you could do it outside of a computer. And that does take a little bit of the wow factor away, that you're just like, holy shit, they must have run a crazy program to get that done. But so to his credit, he's still got that sort of visionary mind of a good director who can see how an action sequence is supposed to play out and then just tweak it using the technology available to him at the time. However, the fact that he uses that to do 100% of a movie is really disappointing. In my mind, this powerful technology should be used to improve and highlight and to elevate the stuff that you've done practically, and then yes, to be able to do certain things like that. That's just how I look at it. But it's just a big playground for him, and that's kind of unfortunate that he doesn't pick and choose.
I was thinking earlier today about I think it was pretty clear at the outset. I mean, Peter Jackson did not want to make these movies. He didn't, not that he didn't want to make them, he didn't want to direct them. And that's why Guillermo del Toro was hired. And I would just be so fascinated to what Guillermo del Toro would have done, because it would have carried none of the baggage of Lord of the Rings, because it would just been a completely new interpretation, and it'd be like different director, same characters, but unmistakably another vision, and that way the two worlds could be separated. And I think that would have been fascinating. I'm not saying it would have worked,
and I think,
but
that's,
it would have been interesting.
I think that's what Jackson's initial intent was, because he said that he wanted a different director to do it because he was worried he couldn't make it different enough. And I think that would have been so exciting, because Del Toro was teasing all these crazy dragon designs. He said Smaug was going to be a dragon that we've never seen before, and I was so excited for it. And I think when Jackson stepped in to the ring, like, I don't know if he's still... I was thinking back on this earlier, because this movie had such development. You remember when it was supposed to be two movies? One was The Hobbit, and one was like a bridge between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And then they had talked about, you know, maybe bringing back cast, and then they were expanding it. And I wonder what all these other ideas could have been. And I wonder if and then there was the talk of like how the first movie was supposed to be really light, and then it was going to slowly get darker and move into Lord of the Rings. I wonder if that's still what they're doing here. I don't know. It's interesting to see what Jackson has made now, because there were such different plans early on, and I wonder what his end game is with this trilogy and how it's supposed to connect with Lord of the Rings. Because to me, it doesn't feel like the same environment. I mean, they're shooting on digital, and they're using so much CG, and like even the sets, like all the stuff at Rivendell in the first movie looks really not great.
Even the way they're handling just the
story. I mean, when you say first
too.
Movie, you're talking Unexpected Journey,
Unexpected
not
Journey,
Fellowship.
Yeah. No, because think back to Fellowship. That feels like a real
it does.
Village. And it's so crazy to think a movie made a decade ago looks better than
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I mean, going to your point about George Lucas, this is you're going back in time and using more advanced technology, and apparently this disconnect isn't obvious.
Yeah, and I don't understand it. I don't understand how they don't see it.
Yeah,
I think it's just a case of them being too close into it. Because, I mean, think about it. When they're looking at... Their process is basically like you get dailies in and then just shoot them directly into the computer. And it's like that's not even... you don't even look at that anymore. Like your cinematographer has now been sort of relegated to the video booth to light a CG scene more than the actual practical scene.
And I will say this.
It's going right into the computer.
I will say this, though. This film, I presume that Warner Brothers is like, you have to make these in 3D because that's the marketplace now.
It was half of their take this weekend.
Exactly. So that's the marketplace. And so that's the thing. If you're going to make your film in 3D, then it sort of changes the way you make it. Because I think if you try to make The Fellowship of the Ring in 3D, it can't, quote-unquote, take advantage of it. Because they're just not built for it. They don't have, you know, the depth of field is not built that way. So in these films, you build, like, the Goblin Caves or Erebor, where it just stretches on forever, and you just have to do that digitally. But that creates new problems.
Which sucks, because the 3D is so unremarkable.
Like, it really is.
3D, and it adds nothing. It's like seeing a Marvel movie in 3D.
I'm glad I didn't, to be honest with you, because that would have distracted me. So I'm kind of glad that I didn't. And it did distract me that the fact that they were like, you know, when a spear comes through the screen, they're still kind of doing those
the
hokey
fucking
gimmicks.
Bee. That bee and was bee. So
I knew.
Stupid.
I'm looking at it. I'm like, I guarantee that's in 3D.
It made me so angry because it made me like go cross-eyed. I was like, really? I was like, you're like, because I was already annoyed with like, because I was going into this, I was like, oh, everyone likes it better. I'm real excited. But then I saw like the bloat, and then I was like, really? You got time to make this fucking CG bee that's gonna come at my face? Really? Is this necessary?
I put dinner on the table, man. Some guy in a recording booth worked on that for 6 months.
Bee man.
Just unnecessary. That's the theme of this entire movie.
Well, that's the other thing about CG 3D, and I mean, we could talk about this with other films, is that the more you try to highlight it, the more it can hurt it in the long run. I watched my DVD screener of Gravity, and it's still impressive, but it's not majestic. Now, obviously, that has to do with screen size, but there is that moment where the screw is sort of floating out of the screen, and Clooney grabs for it, and it still looks really good. But you'll always know what it was supposed to be, and that to me pulls you out of a film because you're really watching two different movies at that point.
See, and on that point, too, this kind of goes back to sort of a reason. I don't know if we already answered this or not. I don't think we did. But why, an actual practical reason behind why they want to replace everything that's filmed practically with digital effects. When you get to that high frame rate, that sort of clarity kind of reveals flaws in practical effects, which whether it be the set, whether it be the costuming, whether it be the makeup, any of that. So I feel like almost at that point, they're like, well, we do have this available, so we should probably just do it this way, so people aren't picking apart the, you know, the flaws that they see between, you know, through the fourth wall. So that's just maybe one practical reason, but it doesn't answer.
Well, it's like the tech is dictating the art,
yes.
And that's
yes.
not necessarily bad. I mean, going back to Gravity, the way tech and art intersects in that film is fantastic. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, but with The Hobbit, it feels like they had the technology first and now they're trying to solve it, whereas with Gravity they actually had to invent the technology in order mm-hmm. to reach the art that they wanted. So it's working the other way.
It's also kind of unfortunate that the tech is so, it is really, really good and powerful, but it doesn't limit you. It's sort of the same way that, like, if you're limited by a budget, you have to get creative and you have to make hard decisions. When you don't have that limitation, you end up with a lot of bloat like this, and I think that's just kind of par for the course for these films, unfortunately.
When you can see that in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, because and I think this is the perfect test case, because I mean, you look back to when Jackson was initially making the Lord of the Rings trilogy, he had a year to shoot all three movies, which was crazy, and they had like five different units going at the same time. Like I know Fran Walsh was directing like a mile away.
One of their producers, Barry Osborne, I think, was that
Yeah, yeah. But like the passion, like, because they had to get it done and they were under the wire, they had to get it. And then as Fellowship came out and it's a huge success, and same with Two Towers, and Jackson did pick up shots on all of those. So that's why it's not a big surprise when he goes back and does reshoots on The Hobbit. So, you know, he went back and did pickups for all three of the Lord of the Rings movies. But you see when it gets to Return of the King, where, you know, this is a massive franchise and they went back and did pickups, you can see the effects starting to kind of take over at the end of that, but it still works because he's laid this incredible foundation. But the battle at the end of Return of the King is so different from the climax of Fellowship of the Ring, which is just a practical like sword fight.
Or even Helm's Deep. Helm's Deep.
Oh, I love Helm's Deep.
They've entirely done away with using miniatures, which made the Lord of the Rings trilogy so beautiful when the camera goes over and looks at these crazy structures, it's really cool. Whereas in The Hobbit,
or when they blow
the
apart,
cameras, in The Hobbit, the camera is digital. Like they didn't film anything.
You're right. It's an animated film.
Yeah, you're watching an animated film, which is when I first saw high frame rate, I thought, I don't love this, but I would be interested to see an animated movie that way. And I wonder, like, going back to the tech dictating the story, I wonder if they were like, wow, our animated and CG portions look so great in high frame rate. Let's do more of those.
Perhaps. I mean, but I'm with you. I think that it'll be interesting to see. First off, I don't think HFR 3D is going to take off with anyone.
No. Other
than James Cameron. doing it for Avatar, which I don't give a shit about because those movies don't interest me. It's really, in that way, that is a tech demo, and James Cameron should just go do whatever. But I'm with you. I'd like to see HFR3D, maybe how it applies to an animated film, and especially how it would apply to nature documentaries.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what we talked about last time, because it's just like the establishing shots in the first Hobbit movie. They were gorgeous. I mean, it was beautiful to watch that in high frame rate. You could literally see every little blade of grass and petal on a flower, and that'd be beautiful to watch in a nature documentary. But I think it should be used sparingly, if at all, on these types of films.
Right.
That means absolute shit, because I'm not in the business. So.
Sure. Who cares? We're in the business. We're just at the bottom of the food chain.
Yeah. Well, and interesting, going back to Jackson, you know, going in and completely like CG removing characters. He did that on Return of the King, which I didn't know until I watched the extended editions, like the bonus features on that. In the final battle on the ground at Sauron's gate, Sauron would, like, they filmed Sauron on the field fighting with Aragorn and everyone, and then decided, like, oh no, we don't want, like, the physical Sauron there, so they just replaced him with, like, an orc. So, like, when you see Aragorn and like Gandalf, like, fighting this orc or I can't remember what creature it is, like, on the fields, like, when they shot that, it was Sauron.
One of the big trolls or something, I think.
Yeah, I think it was like a troll.
And like all that crazy armor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it, like, the idea of Jackson going back and like doing like tweaks and changing things last minute and stuff isn't new, but I still thought that was interesting.
No, yeah. I will say that, like, the dwarves and sort of the more human-type characters, I'm assuming that's all just practical makeup with maybe a little bit of CG kind of touch-over. Because the only one that looked a little strange to me was Legolas, because it looked like they tried to, like,
make him
rejuvenate
younger.
Him a little bit. Yeah, make him a little younger. But the rest of the makeup looked, I thought it was pretty good. So,
yeah. Well, Orlando Bloom doesn't age, though. So
That helps. That helps him, not aging. But I would also say, now I'm a little concerned, though, with... Again, we've talked about these digital effects and mm-hmm. the disjointed. Because I really don't want The Hobbit to touch Lord of the Rings in terms of quality. Or create new revelations that are like, oh, damn it, now I can't watch this again without mm-hmm. thinking of this. Because really, The Hobbit as a prequel trilogy, I mean, we all know where it's going in terms of plot setup. But right. there's always insidious little things that could disrupt what should not be touched. Right. I mean, that's the thing. If The Hobbit fails, and I don't want to say it's a complete failure, but I don't think its shortcomings should drag down Lord of the Rings. So that's why I'm hoping. I'm hoping it doesn't drag down Lord of the Rings. And so far, it hasn't.
Right. Yeah, the first one I thought actually set up the trilogy fairly well. There were a lot of, I can't remember them right now, but there were a lot of cool little moments that, like, two characters would be talking. And if you were watching The Hobbit for the first time and had never seen Lord of the Rings, you wouldn't really pick up on it. It was subtly done in the first film, not so much in the second one. That kind of worries me for the third one and how closely they want to tie in. And I think to reference the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but to kind of leave it alone is the best course of action. So I'm with you. I'm a little worried for this last film.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the test case because, mm-hmm. I mean, you know that they worked on a bridge film, so they have it mapped out, or they at one point had mapped out how they were going to try and connect The Hobbit with Lord of the Rings, so I wonder how much of that carries on. And I was interested to see that Guillermo del Toro is still credited with the screenplay for the second film. Well, no,
he has an and credit, which means he is, some of his script is in there.
Yeah.
So I would also say, but this might be a good chance to move into one other thing I wanted to touch on, which mm-hmm. we were talking about the box office. And Mike Ryan on Huffington Post made the point that Lord of the Rings, these were event films. This was like show up at midnight, people are going to talk about it. This was a big deal. Now it's a different
Saturday Night Live. Like,
exactly.
It's
now it's a different environment altogether than it was 10 years ago in terms of the amount of blockbusters out there. And Peter Jackson has done a couple films in between that didn't meet as warm of a reception. And the way people talk about films in terms of the online space, Twitter, Facebook, that has all changed. That changes the conversation in a way where there are more entertainment options, more mm-hmm. parodies, so on, so forth. That being said, this is not an event like it was before. The shine has been taken off. And I don't know what you guys think, but for me, I think maybe if Unexpected Journey had hit the mark, it would have pushed everything back up again. But I think what we're seeing now is we will see these movies they will be fine. we're not excited for them. I mean, Mike Ryan uses the term obligated, and I wouldn't go quite that far, but almost. The last time I felt obligated to see a blockbuster film was Revenge of the Sith. And I obligingly saw it at midnight because I'm like, I fucking did this with the other two. I just like, let's finish this fucking thing. There's one more. I don't really care, but let's just do this. And I don't feel that way about Desolation of Smog, but I do feel like this is such a big film. Why am I not more excited? And I know why I'm not more excited.
Yeah, it just kind of like snuck up. It was kind of like, oh yeah, Desolation of Smog comes out soon. You know, and I was so excited for Unexpected Journey because, I mean, I thought those trailers were great.
Oh yeah,
I was
great
so
trailers.
Back to the world of Middle Earth, but it was like, this isn't Middle Earth. And I still know plenty of people who haven't seen Unexpected Journey, so I wonder if that enthusiasm, like the, you know, mediocre reviews and just everyone saying, eh, it's not as good. I think people are, 3 hours is a lot to commit to something. And
it's a lot to commit, and especially when you've seen so many other blockbusters this year, and when you have other options, to be frank. You can still go see Hunger Games. You can go see Frozen.
Right.
So you have, in terms of like a film that you can, you know, reasonably bring your family to, in terms of like a blockbuster.
That's what they were saying as far as the box office performance of this one, that it came in, I don't know, about 10 million short of the first Hobbit, at least domestically. It did about the same internationally, but they were basically blaming the strength of the competition, the fact there are other quote-unquote family-friendly films, and also
but there's
really
there's
the
always
weather,
a ton of stuff.
Yeah, there's always a ton of stuff.
Yeah,
that's not to say. I'm just
their,
saying
this
that.
Is their talking points for
yeah,
why.
I would just say if it's no, I mean their talking points. I think they're relevant, but also I think you know the shine is off
a
little
story.
Bit.
Yeah.
Ten million short with 3D is actually, and in, if what you said is true, if it was 50% 3D, that's a pretty big drop.
Yeah, the wrap has a little write-up on it. They say, let's see, 49% of the haul came from 3D. Top 10 grossing theaters featured IMAX, which accounted for 9 million, or 12% of the total. 21% of the total gross came from large format auditoriums, which I don't know what that really matters. I was on a few... I was on less than 4,000 screens this time around as well, and it was on more than 4,000 the last time, so they did cut back on the number of initial screenings, at least. Again, I don't know how much all this
right.
really
and,
means.
And ultimately, I don't think it really means anything, because the third movie's going to come out anyway.
Exactly.
And furthermore, it's box office is always deceptive, because, you know, underperformed, whatever. Domestic box office is an indicator. That's all it is. Every movie makes its money back eventually through international sales and licensing rights. Yeah. And we're only seeing a snapshot. And that's really it. So all this like Monday morning quarterback of, oh, if they did this, they did that. Yeah, it's entertaining, but it's also misleading.
Doesn't mean shit. And see, the problem with that is when, you know, the first one makes a billion, but everybody knew it had problems. So you're just like, fuck it. Like the second one is going to probably just make another billion on the backs of international audiences. And if people just keep coming out to see it, then why would you change it? You know, why would you mess with it if it worked? So that's kind of probably the studio's standpoint, and unfortunately, we're just going to get what we get.
Right. So on the plus side, there really aren't going to be any more Hobbit films, because no one's... That's it. This
nobody's
is the end of it. No one's touching it.
Don't,
you know.
Don't curse it. Don't.
Oh, yeah. Someone's going to come up with J.J. Abrams will direct Hobbit films from scratch.
I could just see so many lens flares off of the swords every
single
time.
Oh, God.
That'd be amazing.
Every time. Every fucking time.
Jackson James' mind is like, we're doing a fourth movie. It's going to be the bridge between the Hobbit and the Lord.
See, now, that's interesting to me, because some of the stuff they're trying to set up, at least with this second movie, it's like you're getting dangerously close to things that happen in Lord of the Rings, and yet it's a span of, what, 50 to 80 years later, probably? Something like
it
that.
It says 60 years earlier.
60 years? So,
60
I mean,
years.
I am a little worried about that, too, because I almost want them to just like stay very far away from each other and let each trilogy kind of stand on its own. You can have little tethers tying each other, you know, to each other just to make sure we're in the same world, but... I don't know. I'm a little suspect of that.
Sure. Yeah, it's going to be tricky. But yes, let's tempt fate, because I'm sure... No. It's okay, because once he's done with these films, he's going to do a Tintin movie I don't give a shit
That's
about.
That's true, his Tintin sequel. Yeah.
It's so... His career trajectory is so weird, because, I mean, his early career was the...
It was horror
like
films.
The, yeah, horror films, like horror comedies, and then The Lord of the Rings was great, and I think King Kong is where it started this, maybe even Return of the King is where the bloat thing started, because Return of the King is long, and it has a lot of endings, but I didn't mind because I didn't mind,
and I think the problem is people, you know, slam it with a lot of endings. I think it's poor editing. I think the problem is that it uses a lot of fade-outs, and fade-outs are deceptive. It's like, oh, this is the ending. I think it's just cut together poorly as much as more than like, oh, it's bloated. But I can see where you're coming from.
But King Kong is, and that was the first one, like, they were like, oh, wow, like, it's Peter Jackson's first movie since Lord of the Rings. Yeah. But like,
he's lost a lot of weight.
That movie was long.
And full of just really unnecessary things.
Whatever weight he lost, he put into that movie. Because there was just
he put it into the bug scenes.
Oh, my God. And I liked that movie, too. I enjoyed it. But, yeah, that definitely could have been cut.
Yeah, all the Jamie Bell stuff has no purpose whatsoever.
The dinosaur wrecking ball rolling down the chasm there. Yeah. Not necessary.
And even Lovely Bones is over 2 hours long, which is
And all of that movie is shit.
I don't think it's entirely shit. It's certainly not a good movie, but
I think I dislike it more because I think it's really strong source material, and I would have been interested to see what Lynn Ramsey would have done with it, assuming she had shown up to film it. Let's hang that on her over her for the rest of her career.
That followed her before it actually happened.
That's exactly. It follows her in an alternate universe
time.
I just created.
That's the new Terminator reboot plot right there, actually.
Oh, God. All right. Let's talk about how those films will affect other Terminator films.
It'll be interesting to see what Jackson does after he's done with Hobbit, and assuming Tintin happens. Like, what is he just going to stay in this big, giant franchise blockbuster mode? I know he said something to the effect later that he and Fran wanted to get back to smaller, like, Heavenly Creature-style movies, but I just can't see him doing that.
I mean, maybe he'll do what Spielberg did in terms of, I mean, since Spielberg has done small. He did, I mean, I would say, you know, small for Spielberg is Catch Me If You Can, The Terminal. So there are directors who can go back to that. There are directors who can go home again in that sense.
I think the good thing is that the Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit obviously are not Jackson's creations. The thing we were talking about with Lucas earlier, like, that's his baby. So, like, he felt, I think rightfully so, that he could go back and tinker with it. I disagree with what came out of it, but, I mean, that was his to do, pretty much. Jackson, at least, can't really do this unless somebody's like, yeah, sure, go for it again. So hopefully he'll just move on to some
And they're not on good terms with the Tolkien estate, so that's just not. And everyone says the Silmarillion sucks, so no one wants that either.
Now that I don't know. I haven't read it, so I can't.
It's apparently unreadable, so
it's like a history book from what I understand, isn't it?
I honestly don't know a damn thing about it other than everyone hates it. I really don't. That's all I know about it. And it's kind of, again, it's kind of irrelevant because
Christopher Nolan's The Silmarillion. I don't even know how to say it.
Exactly. Oh, gosh. That Interstellar trailer. I don't want to get into it, but I like it, but it kind of feels like up until the end, it could be like a car commercial.
Or here's anything else.
Like, it could sell you life insurance.
Since we're talking about that, Korn.
Korn, yes! That made me so happy that turned out to be true.
But the fact that, like, the trailers and stuff were pretty sci-fi heavy, this, I think we might have talked about fantasy and the state of fantasy movies last time. This is kind of like, it's the last sort of fantasy movie that's out there, and it feels like a fun, kind of light fantasy film, but I don't know, the digital aspect of it kind of takes that away, in a sense.
Well, it's sort of like,
do you guys feel the same way on that?
I do. I feel like the thing was when The Lord of the Rings came out, there was like everyone started chasing fantasy properties, and then they all died. So Aragorn sucked. You know, The Seeker, The Dark is Rising, that sucked. The Golden Compass, which actually killed New Line. Like, The Lord of the Rings saved New Line, and then they did The Golden Compass, killed New Line.
There were more books for each of those.
Exactly. That's the thing. Everyone wanted their big fantasy franchise, and none of them happened. Yep. And I don't think, and this time around, that it's just a different marketplace, and everyone wants young adult novels. Because also, in terms of what they cost, I'm sure a Divergent costs a lot less than a big fantasy story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but it's just we're just not going to see any big fantasy film for a while, I don't think, because Hobbit has it, you know, for the next year or so. And
doing anything that's making studios really bullish on fantasy. Right. They're not looking at The Hobbit and saying, like, oh, this is doing really, really well. Like, box office-wise, it's doing okay, but, you know, that's I would assume that a majority of the reason that the movie's doing so well is because of its brand recognition and name recognition.
Yeah, sure.
If it's not enjoying the critical reviews, why would another studio go out on a limb and try another fantasy property?
Yeah, if there is going to be another fantasy property, it'll probably be like some new book that tears up like the bestseller charts.
Or it'll be King Conan.
Oh, yeah.
Really the only other thing I can think of that's out there.
Yeah, there you go.
The next Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling.
She's
the Bard.
She's back to screenwriting now, so that'll be a shot in the arm.
Yes, I hope that comes out in 2015.
Why not?
She's finished. Let's hit the ground running. 2015. I get angry now every time a film comes. Oh shit! Warcraft is fantasy.
Oh yeah.
There you go. Yeah, it's not dead completely. Warcraft. We will put our hope in that and Duncan
2016
Jones.
Now? Is that March?
2016. March 2016.
Smart, because it was opening against a little movie called Star Wars Episode 7, if I remember correctly.
I'm not familiar with that movie. You should tell me more.
For another podcast.
All right. Cool. You guys want to do recommendations?
Yeah, it sounds good to me.
All right. Adam, what do you got?
I am recommending Peter Jackson film pre-Lord of the Rings, and it is his 1996 comedy horror film, The Frighteners, which was, I think it was his last movie before he went into Lord of the Rings. I think he tried to get King Kong made first, but then Lord of the Rings came next. But The Frighteners is wildly different than the Peter Jackson that you know now. It is heavy on practical effects and makeup, very low on CG. It's really dark. It stars Michael J. Fox as he's an architect whose wife is killed in a car accident and gains the ability to see ghosts, and he uses that to his advantage to go and kind of not really scam other people, but he's seen as the con man, so he goes to houses and quote unquote exorcises the ghosts from the houses. But he really there's three ghosts that follow him around all the times: a 1970s gangster, 1950s kind of nerdy guy, and then a gunslinger from the Old West, and they'll go in the house and kind of make stuff move, and then, you know, Michael J. Fox will say, "All right, ghosts are gone, give me money." But the crux of the story is that the Grim Reaper, so-called, starts going around and killing people around the town, and so they call upon Michael J. Fox to kind of figure out what's going on, and it all connects to this serial killer murder from 32 years earlier at this at this hospital. And it's really, really dark. It's funny, but it frightened me quite a bit, I guess, which makes sense because it's called The Frighteners, when I saw it when I was younger. But it has a fun score by Danny Elfman, and the effects are really great. There's, you know, people's jaws are dropping off and all kinds of stuff. So if you haven't seen it, I would suggest you see it. Arlie Ermey is in it, Jake Busey. It was made in New Zealand, so it has a bunch of kind of New Zealand actors and stuff. But if you haven't seen it, check it out, The Frighteners.
Yeah, and I would also add that it's Michael J. Fox's last great film. Like, I would say that, you know, I mean, maybe he has another one in him, but...
I think it was his last leading role.
It was his last leading role, for sure.
Yeah.
But he's great in it.
Because then he did Spin City, and then he kind of took off because of the Parkinson's.
Yeah. Okay, but yeah, definitely The Frighteners is the goods. Dave, what do you got?
Speaking of the goods, one of my favorite...
It is not a bad film, but go on.
Mine? Really? Okay, I thought you were going to tear it apart.
No, I've seen it. It's fun.
It's okay. Can't find it anywhere streaming online, so you guys are going to have to work hard for this one. But,
you're talking about the goods? The goods with...
No. I'm talking about my upcoming recommendation. So one of my favorite stats from box office of The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, was that it was number 3 box office so far, all time, in movies that had a dragon as a focal point. I find that stat endearing and ridiculous. Number 5 on that list was the 2002 sort of post-apocalyptic fantasy film, which is a weird one to do, Reign of Fire. Reign of Fire. Now, if you don't remember that one, you're probably in good company. That actually happened to star Christian Bale pre-Batman Begins, pre-Dark Knight trilogy, Matthew McConaughey before the McConaissance that he's currently enjoying, and actually a younger Gerard Butler too, before anybody knew who Gerard Butler was. So there's definitely some action guys in there and some with the exception of Butler, high caliber actors that you can check out in this movie as well. It's kind of a crazy movie. So it's, it sort of starts contemporary times, just a bunch of construction guys just doing their work, and they happen upon a dragon. Wakes a dragon up. That dragon pretty much just lays waste to the world. And actually, one of its first victims is our hero's mother. Now, our hero is the very Britishly named Quinn Abercrombie, who is Christian Bale's character. That might be the only name more British than Benedict Cumberbatch. So as you can guess, Abercrombie grows up to not like dragons very much. We see him when he's a bit older, in the year 2020, which we are rapidly approaching.
So watch out for dragons, motherfuckers.
Watch out for dragons. You don't want to wake them up, because they will kill your mother.
Terrifying.
So Abercrombie is now, he's a grown-up Christian Bale, and he is trying his best to protect and feed and supply and house this, basically just this group of orphans. They're in the northern England, and they're in this kind of burned out, bombed out shell of a castle. Not too many folks left in the world because dragons be eating them all up. So he's trying to survive as best he can and keep everybody together, but they're starting to question his leadership, and they don't really like the way things are going, and they want to change. Lo and behold, the Kentucky Irregulars, which is a random group of Americans that show up with military weapons and a tank and a helicopter, they happen to show up. I don't remember exactly how they got there. I don't think they drove the tank there, so I'm not 100% sure how they got there. But they're led by Matthew McConaughey's character, Denton Van Zandt. Now, he is your prototypical American gung-ho hero who's going to take down all the dragons. If you actually watch the trailer or any of the promo material for this, you probably will remember a shirtless McConaughey flying through the air with a giant axe poised to kill. That should be enough for you to check
the
this
big
movie
beard.
Out. With a giant beard. It's a fun movie, though. It is a bit, they play it a little darker than it probably needs to be. But it's a fun movie, and it's cool to see these guys, you know, 10 years ago before they were much bigger names than they are now. So it's kind of a fun action movie. Like I said, it's not, I don't think it's streaming anywhere right now, so you're going to have to work a little harder to find this one. But if you're curious and want to see the fifth best box office of a movie with a dragon as a focal point, check out Rain of Fire.
Okay. My recommendation is coming off the fact that this has been, I don't want to say the year of Benedict Cumberbatch, because none of his movies have really taken off that much. I mean, other than Star Trek, and even that one sort of gets slammed with being, you know, bad critic, you know, controversial and didn't perform as well as the first one, noticing a trend here. He's the voice of Smaug, for people who don't know. And technically he has one left for people who haven't seen August Osage County, but I have. So for me, this was the last Cumberbatch performance, and this leads me to a film called Four Lions, which he's in for about 2 minutes. But I wanted to tell you about Four Lions, which is a 2010 British comedy, which is about four aspiring terrorists who they are really bad at it. They're bad coming up with a mission statement. They're not exactly sure why they're doing it in terms of a clear goal. It's a very British comedy in terms of sort of the petty disputes and cross purposes, but it is kind of like has a heart. Like, I mean, and it's so weird to be like, oh, these terrorists aren't so bad. They want to kill a lot of people, but they're just so dumb about it, which is kind of endearing in its own way. But the film also finds a interesting way to weave in an element of gravity to it. So there is some seriousness to the picture, not in terms of being preachy about something, but more in terms of sympathy for the characters, which I do find even more surprising. But this is a really good film. I believe it was the first film that Drafthouse Films ever picked up for distribution. So good on them. And that means it's probably on Netflix Instant. So I would highly encourage you to check out the comedy with just a hint of drama. But if you're seeing it for Benedict Cumberbatch, you're probably going to be sorely disappointed. See Four Lions. Okay, so next week, we are coming close to the end of the year, but not quite. And I will want to talk at least probably a little bit about Anchorman 2, because I am very excited for it, but my word, have they been marketing the hell out of it, which is, again, which is amusing to no end, because Paramount didn't want to make this movie in forever. They just had an empty spot on their schedule, and they're like, all right, we'll make it. And now it's like, we will fucking kill in December. We want all the money that there is in the world. I can't... Was there another... Can you guys think of another film off the top of your head that's, like, been marketed in so many different ways?
This, like, has to be the only way they funded this movie, by all the promises of these promotions. Like, that's the only way. I think they
sure
got it, because this is crazy.
Yeah,
well, I mean, the film has definitely picked up a fan base over since the first one, so I'm excited.
Well, and if enough people see it, maybe we'll get Zoolander 2 as well.
Oh, yeah.
They have the same problem. The studio's like... Ben Stiller's like, but we made a ton of money on DVD. They're like, but no, it didn't make a lot of money. But like, well, we have fans, I promise.
Yeah, maybe, and depending on how Secret Life of Walter Mitty does and Ben Stiller's schedule. So.
That's actually a prequel to Zoolander, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays
Secret
out.
Life, yeah, that is true, guys. Spoiler alert, Walter Mitty becomes Derek Zoolander.
He hits his head at the end of the movie.
And when he hits his head, he becomes a male model, and he can no longer turn left.
Explains everything.
It really does. Alright, thanks for listening, everyone. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw, MD.
Alright, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.